Good evening. My name is Paul Holden Graber. I'm the Director of Public Programs at the New York Public Library, now known as Live from the New York Public Library. I would like to warmly welcome everyone tonight to an evening with Walter Ben Michaels, David Simon, Susan Strait, and Dale Peck, an evening moderated, or as I say, better yet, instigated by Chris Lehmann. A quick but timely word about supporting this extraordinary institution known as the New York Public Library. I would like to ask everyone present to consider becoming a friend of the library, starting for as little as $40 a year, which in my view is a cheap date you are in. So please become a friend of the New York Public Library. Your support will get you a ticket for $15 to all live events instead of the $25, so you get a $10 savings. There's a membership table outside, so please visit it after the event and join us tonight. You can, of course, also join online. So what really are you supporting by supporting us? Well, quite simply and joyously, what I try to do is to bring you live conversations, discussion, debates, dissent, if possible, to present you with what I like to refer to. I was asked to define what I do in two words, so I found these two words, cognitive theater. From now on, you will also have the pleasure of viewing the events on iTunes University, on our website, reading transcripts of past evenings of our conversations. For instance, you'll be able to see John Hope Franklin, the late John Hope Franklin, and President Clinton, Al Sharpton, debating the existence of God with Christopher Hitchens, Gunter Grass and the late Norman Mailer. This was actually his last appearance at the library. Zadie Smith, Toni Morrison, Alfred Brendel, Jan Morris, Robert Badinter, Jhumpa Lahiri, Werner Herzog, Matthias Sen with Salman Rushdie, or our recent tribute to John Updike, or last night, if you so care, you will soon be able to see me as Mark Twain. I made a cameo appearance last night as Twain for our Dada Goes Gaga event with Andrei Codrescu and Henry Alford. Coming up next Friday, April 24th, is a conversation with Ari Folman, the filmmaker and director of the Oscar-nominated Waltz with Bashir. He will be debating Reza Aslan, the author of No God But God, and the forthcoming How to Win a Cosmic War. On May 11th, a two-part evening with Alex Ross, Barbara Eisenberg, and Frank Gehry, followed by a conversation between Alex Ross and composer and conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen. They'll be discussing everything from Stravinsky to Radiohead. On June 8th, I will be having a conversation with Alain de Botton on the pleasures and also sorrows of work. Add to that a festival. We are bringing together some 20 European countries. I'm telling you, that is a very, very tall order. On the subject of Islam in Europe, part of the Muslim Voices Festival, spearheaded by BAM, NYU, the Asia Society, which will happen around town from June 4th to June 14th, and much more. Join our email list, but also, and here's something brand new and exciting for us, join our blog, which is simply www.nypl.org/blog. After the conversation and Q&A, please join our talent for a book signing. We are always very happy to be working with our wonderful independent bookseller, 192 Books. Tonight's event is a second in what will become an ongoing series entitled Cultural Obituaries. Last week, we examined the deaths of black nationalism in the Obama era. Tonight, we are celebrating the deaths of boom culture. And please, always after the word deaths, read that the stress lies on the question mark. It has been a pleasure to discuss and devise a series with the publishers and editors of Book Forum, our partners, supporters, co-presenters tonight, Tony Corner, Charles Guarino, Knight Landisman, and Chris Lehmann, and the guardian angel of Book Forum who brings us all together, my friend Danielle McConnell. Our thoughts meshed and intertwined very well and in a congenial fashion. I must make a confession which I made last time, and it will be the second time I will make it. Or as my mother said, I'll do it twice, the first and the last time. I start every morning by simply reading the obituaries. I have a a passion for obituaries. And recently I actually put that passion into practice by having an evening here at the New York Public Library, which was called Live from the New York Public Library Presents Dead from the New York Public Library. I invited the obituary writer, probably the best in the world in my view, from The Economist, Anne Rowe, to speak about obituaries, and in the audience we had the pleasure of having half of the undertakers of the New York Times here, and they were sort of comparing how they did the dead. The difference with The Economist only has 52 dead a year. The New York Times has many, many, many more. A very lively evening it was, and I hope tonight it will be also a very lively evening we will have. Where am I here? Chris Lehmann, the editor of Book Forum, will explain to you in what way the cultural obituaries works itself nicely into the pages of Book Forum. Chris will also introduce a talent tonight and ask, I hope, from each one of them to say something about themselves which is not on the flyer you have read. Chris is not only the new editor of Book Forum, but also the senior editor of Congressional Quarterly, formerly deputy editor of the Washington Post, Book World, and a former columnist for the New York Observer. Walter Ben Michael's Going Boom serves as an inspiration and starting point for the evening tonight. You will find it in the January-February issue of Book Forum. If you don't have a copy, please pick one up on your way out. I find my inspiration both in Walter's fine essay, Going Boom, and in Walter Benjamin's essay on the storyteller. It is a pleasure to leave you with good old Benjamin's words before Chris Lehmann welcomes and introduces David Simon, and I would like to let you know that his interview will air on Friday at 9:30 on Bill Moyer's Journal in New York, so please listen to that. Susan Strait, Dale Peck, and Walter Ben Michaels. And here to the storyteller of Walter Benjamin. Counsel woven into the fabric of real life is wisdom. The art of storytelling is reaching its end because the epic side of truth, wisdom, is dying out. This, however, is a process that has been going on for a long, long time, and nothing would be more fatuous than to want to see in it merely a symptom of decay, let alone a modern symptom. It is rather only a concomitant symptom of the secular productive forces of history, a concomitant that has quite gradually removed narrative from the realm of living speech and at the same time is making it possible to see a new beauty in what is vanishing. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Going Boom.
Thanks, everyone, for coming out. Whoa, there's odd echo there. I'm Chris Lehmann. I'm not, in fact, the editor of Book Forum. I have to say that because the other editor of Book Forum, Albert Mobilio, is seated right over there. I am an editor of Book Forum, and I approached the idea behind this column, which is called Last Things, a little differently Paul's passion for the obituary. I, like most people, have a more ambivalent relationship with obituaries, I think. But I like the idea of using the conceit of a cultural moment passing to have a writer weigh in on the impact and meaning of that moment, and to also, you know, in the spirit of a death and life kind of idea, which I think that Benjamin quote was getting at in part, is, you know, to look at whatever is aborn in the wake of the thing we're declaring dead or possibly critically ill. And conveniently, just as I was assigning this first column that Walter went up writing, the American economy basically died. and that was sort of my excuse, you know, to engage a subject that has long sort of baffled me about contemporary fiction, and more broadly, what I wound up calling, for the purposes of this column, boom culture, which is to say everything from memoirs to reality television to TV to movies, which I hope we'll all address at some point tonight. There's a, you know, a striking paucity of the experience of ordinary working class or poor Americans. And, you know, obviously a lot of these, the industries that make these cultural products know what they're doing, they market test what they're doing, and they have, you know, at a moment of, you know, truly epic economic collapse, had sort of left us with this oddly hollowed out kind of cultural expression where what a lot of people who are losing their mortgages or health insurance or jobs, you know, were conspicuously absent from a lot of the stories being told in our broader culture. So that led me in turn to think, well, who, you know, who's a critic who can sort of talk about these things in many different registers? And it was a very, I have to say, a very short list, which I would argue is part of the condition that we're all here to discuss. And it so happened Walter Ben Michaels had previously written a book on the gold standard in American fiction and written another book about the diversity industry and how it contorts our perceptions of class. So I decided, you know, he's got the basic tools here. Let me turn him loose on the subject. And gratifyingly, he said yes. But he came away with a more precise argument, arguing that there are certain kinds of stories that we have given inordinate value to over and above, you know, stories about social class, you know, put very broadly. And that essay is what we wound up publishing. It's always, you know, a dicey thing, as we all know, to sort of bring politics forthrightly in a discussion of storytelling. But I think anyone who's recently been following the Amazon delisting scandal, which they have opportunistically called a glitch, knows that you can't really divorce political questions from the delivery of culture. It's an inherent part of everyone's lives, very, you know, natural thing for us all to talk about overtly. And I think Walter has done a very good job. And rather than continue to set my characterization of Walter's argument loose, because we happen to have Walter right here, I thought I would... yes, it's like the Marshall McLuhan moment in Annie Hall. He's going to read it. So, oh, and because I forgot to do this last time, I'm going to quickly introduce everyone. That, as you've gathered, is Walter Ben Michaels, whose most recent books are The Shape and the Shape of the Signifier and The Trouble with Diversity. He's currently completing a book called The Death of a Beautiful Woman, Form and Intent and in Recent American Art. To my left here is David Simon, whose narrative nonfiction works Homicide in the Corner became NBC drama and HBO miniseries, respectively, and subsequently the HBO drama The Wire. Most recently, he is writer and executive producer for the HBO miniseries Generation Kill. He's now working on a series named Treme about a group of musicians in post-Katrina New Orleans. He also writes for The New Yorker, Esquire, and The Washington Post. Now, skipping over to the man with the tie, that is Dale Peck. He is the author of 9 books, most recently Body Surfing, a novel, and Sprout, which is also a novel, but for teenagers. He teaches in the graduate writing program of the New School. And to his left is Susan Straits, professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside. Her 5th novel, High Wire Moon, was a National Book Award finalist. And she is now working on a sequel to her 2007 novel, A Million Nightingales, set in post-Katrina New Orleans. The two of you should talk. Okay, I'm done. Walter Ben Michaels. Okay.
So Chris asked me to read a version of the piece with the theory that it would be the quickest way to get started. So I am going to read it. I cut it a little bit. For those of you who haven't read it, like, you could read along or something, but it seems just an efficient way to get going. So what was the boom? The boom was a period starting in the late 1970s and punctuated by the occasional recession in which the American economy grew substantially, but in which the vast majority of that growth went to the upper classes. In 1977, the top quintile, that's the top fifth, of American wage earners made 44% of all the money made in the U.S. The bottom quintile, this is back in 1977, made 4.2%. In 2006, the top quintile made 50.5%. The bottom quintile, 3.4%. So the boom mainly was a boom for rich people. What was boom culture? Well, insofar as the people who write books and poems and shows on cable subscription TV and the people who read and watch them are mainly the upper quintile and their children, boom culture stories have been mainly stories told by rich people to other rich people. And what those stories have mainly been about is how virtuous rich people are, especially how virtuous the educated, anti-racist, anti-sexist, pro-gay marriage, etc., rich people of today are, when compared not only to the poor people of today, but to the rich people of the past. For one of the major genres of boom culture was the novel about very bad things that happened in the past. It's no accident that Toni Morrison's 1987 novel, Beloved, was proclaimed the best novel of the period by the New York Times, or that prominent runners-up included books like Blood and Meridian, Underworld, and The Plot Against America. Indeed, even younger writers like Michael Chabon and Colson Whitehead have rushed to take up the burden of the past. And it's not hard to see why. For although it's true that books about slavery and the Middle Passage and the Holocaust and the extermination of Native Americans are more or less definitionally sad, it's also true that the logic by which they are produced and which makes them so attractive is an optimistic one. Why? Because trying to overcome, say, the lingering effects of slavery doesn't involve criticizing the primacy of markets. It just involves making sure that everyone has equal access to them. So when Beloved reminds us that we are a nation divided by race and racism, and in case we forget, A Mercy reminds us again, we're effectively being told that our problem is lingering racism, not burgeoning capitalism. And when Morrison wins the Nobel Prize and Obama becomes president, we're being reassured that we are headed in the right direction, even though we're not there yet. But as the current economic catastrophe has the great merit of demonstrating, we are not headed in the right direction. People are losing their health care, their houses, and their jobs for reasons having nothing whatsoever to do with bad things that happened in the past, done to and by our ancestors, and everything to do with bad things happening in the present, done to and by us. Indeed, the only relevant past here is the very recent one, the one in which the triumph of markets that we have learned to call neoliberalism has taken place and during which things have gotten not better, but worse. For a great many Americans, in other words, the boom has been the problem before the crash ever came. But the more unjust and unequal American society has become over the last 30 years, the more we have heard about, say, how bad the Holocaust was. And in the last few years, as the actual Holocaust has begun to show the first signs of brand fatigue, enterprising writers like Roth in The Plot Against America and Chabon in The Yiddish Policeman's Union have boldly moved beyond bad things that happened in the past to bad things that didn't happen in the past. A Nazi takeover of the U.S., the exile of a whole society of Eastern European Jews to Alaska. Your Sarah Palin joke there. Now, however, it's not just poor people, but relatively rich people. Up till now, the boom's beneficiaries who are beginning to feel the pain. And disapproval of Holocaust is getting serious competition from fear of poverty, which is just what the vast majority, the victims of the boom, have been worrying about all along. So maybe it's time for us to forget about the Holocaust and focus on the free market instead, to stop congratulating ourselves on being against genocide, and to start questioning what it means to be for free trade. Although it doesn't appear anywhere on the Times' best books list, Bret Easton Ellis' American Psycho is a far better novel than most of the ones that do. And the Psycho's self-consoling reminder, I am rich, millions are not, has the merit of problematizing the upper middle class's sense of its virtue rather than, like Roth and Morrison, pandering to it. But forgetting about history is just a first step. For if historicist novels have been one way to make the reality of our social arrangements invisible, they haven't been the only way. It was also in 1987, that is the year that Beloved was published, that Margaret Thatcher, as canny a cultural critic as Toni Morrison, pronounced herself tired of hearing about society's problems and dismissed them by claiming there is no such thing as society. There are individual men and women and their families. Anybody looking to explain the appeal of the memoir and contemporary writing need look no further. In this context, all the debates about whether memoirs really count as literature, about whether it matters if they aren't altogether true, are completely irrelevant. Every sentence in every one of them, true or false, literary or not, tells us that there are only individuals, and most memoirs add, their families. So maybe another upside of the collapse of a Thatcherite economy will be the disappearance of this entirely Thatcherite genre. Maybe people will lose all interest in the moving stories of the struggles of other people to overcome destructive, although sometimes seductive, parents, and seductive, although always destructive, addictions, and no one will want to read memoirs. Maybe people will even lose interest in their own struggles thus conceived, and no one will want to write them either. So no memoirs, no historicist novels, what else? Actually, a lot of other novels will have to go too. The end of the novel is sort of like the weather. People are always talking about it, but maybe this time we will get some results. For sure, no more books like The Corrections or any of Oprah's other choices. And no more stories about the children of immigrants trying to figure out whether or where they fit in American culture. Ethnic identity is just the family writ large, and no move is more characteristic of the neoliberal novel than the substitution of cultural difference for class difference. What the neoliberal novel likes about cultural difference is that it sentimentalizes social conflict, imagining that what people really want is respect for their otherness rather than money for their mortgages. But they don't. You get a better sense of the actual structure of American society from any of Ellis's famous descriptions of what people are wearing. A suit by Dries Van Noten. I kind of updated this. It actually says a suit by Lubiom. I don't even know who Lubiom is. So I put in Dries Van Noten. A great-looking striped spread collar shirt from Martin Margiela, used to say Burberry. A silk tie by Resicao, and a belt from, he says here, Ralph Lauren. That's definitely 1992. But you get a better sense of the structure of American society from any of those lists than you do from all the accounts of people reclaiming, refusing, or repurposing their cultural identities. And you get an even better sense of it from something that's not a novel at all, the TV series The Wire, the most serious and ambitious fictional narrative of the 21st century so far. Unlike its more widely watched competitor, The Sopranos, which really was about what David Chase always said it was about, family, The Wire is about institutions, unions, schools, political parties, gangs. It's about the world neoliberalism has actually produced, rather than the world our culture pretends it's produced. If a book like American Psycho looks back to the great novels of Edith Wharton, novels of manners, in which what's always at stake are the hierarchies of the social order, The Wire is like a way of reinventing Zola or Dreiser for a world in which the deification of the market is going out rather than coming in. Although, of course, as my editor Chris Lehman reminded me when I wrote this piece, you did have to pay the HBO subscription fee to watch it. Okay, so now we're...
So I think you can agree there's a lot to discuss there. And I do just want to quickly go around the table and do kind of a lightning round set of responses from everyone except Walter on the panel. And just put the direct question, do we really live in a culture where storytelling is primarily done by, about, and for the rich people, and that celebrates the virtues of the rich? David?
I gotta go first.
Yeah, you're sitting to my left.
Well, I don't know. I don't feel that way. I live in Baltimore. I'm very serious. My boom culture never extended as far as you folks. And I live in a perfectly viable neighborhood. I don't mean to be hyperbolic about where I live. I live 20 blocks away from the other America that is not at all connected. And I've made... The grist for my mill has come from that 20 block, has made that 20 block journey from there to my computer. So the stuff that's interested me has always been apparent, and I'm not sure I feel comfortable equipped to, what literary fiction has preoccupied itself with, not to criticize it or not to, I really feel a little uncomfortable.
Well, let's talk about more than literary fiction then, since, you came off well in Walter's piece.
I ducked the bullet there, apparently.
You were not among the things that will have to go. But your experience making making this your main, narrative work, has it been your sense that it's difficult to interest, television producers in the kind of stories you want to tell?
Well, listen, Hollywood is about, it's about the money.
Right.
And Hollywood is the buyers generally, with the exception of, you know, I mean, HBO is an obscure and very recent dynamic. And the idea that you were going to write a dystopic piece about America, or that you were going to have a non-life-affirming ending, or that you were going to have any political dissent in your piece, when every 13 minutes they were going to stop to sell, you know, iPods and soap and feminine hygiene products, is you know, the programming in network television for the life of the medium has been there to stick in between
that's,
the ads.
Right, it's
they're
an
about
ad
selling
delivery
you stuff.
System.
Right.
Right.
So all of a sudden, this weird little window where there's no ads, and nobody's really looking over your shoulder trying to. So it was an opportunity to speak to something else. And doing that, you had to know that there was, you know, there were places where it would not find an audience. There were people who were going to watch The Wire and feel as if it didn't speak to their world at all. That it was not at all connected to. You know, I don't know. I'm not mean to be flippant, but you know, the Upper West Side of Manhattan,
right,
or Silicon Valley, or you know, or West LA, places where you know, but. You know, I felt like it had a great reception in the places where I cared about, which was the Baltimore neighborhoods.
All right. So. All right. Dale? I feel like I'm in the McLaughlin group here. Same question.
Same. And the question was,
do we inhabit a culture where narratives are driven principally by, for, and about rich people and celebrate their virtues?
I mean, I don't know, I was sitting up here, and as you were listing all the brands, I was thinking, John Varvatos, Prada. But I bought it all used, so I don't know where that puts me in the category. I reread the piece again today, and I'm not quite sure where I, you know, fall on that. Like, on the one hand, I sort of vehemently disagree with everything you say, and then on the other hand, I sort of think everything you say is absolutely true to the point of being self-evident. I mean, speaking of my own experience, I mean, I'm come from an extremely poor background. You know, I was raised in a double-wide trailer, which made us rich by comparison in the neighborhood, with the truck parked in front that sat there for so long that the tree grew through the hood. And, you know, I went to a public high school where, you know, the school district was drawn very specifically so there would be no black people in the school. And, you know, and all that, and now, as I just said, you know, I'm sitting up here in my name brands, and, you know, and I live in a, you know, a nice apartment, and I, you know, certainly wouldn't call myself poor by any means. So, and I don't think I ever wrote a story about rich people. I don't think I ever wrote anything that rich people liked. I mean, I feel like everything I've ever written is about class, but I also wouldn't say that I'm representative in any way of you know, what's happened in the last 25 years. But at the same time, I'm not sure that, you know, anything is representative of the last 25 years. The list of novels that you cited, you know, the Times list, those were actually chosen by writers, and I don't know if that makes it a better list or a worse list. I remember, you know, when sort of an editor at the Times was specifically asking me if I would vote for it, and I said, this is just the stupidest idea ever. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's basically like, you know, everyone who is agreeing to do this list is doing it precisely because the list of the people who chose it is going to appear down the side, and, you know, it's right. Your credit in the Times to see the list, and, you know, I mean, what's not, you know, I mean, hard about Loving Beloved? It's a really great book on all sorts of levels. And when you say things like it doesn't challenge the legitimacy of the market, so I feel like on the one hand, surely it was challenging the legitimacy of the slave market, and on the other hand,
it hasn't been a slave market, you know, sometime.
Right? But I mean, you know, it's sort of challenging that one. But then on the other hand, it seems to be the novel's, you know, raison d'etre, you know, in this argument that if it doesn't challenge burgeoning capitalism, which I, you know, kind of hate, but at the same time make a lot of money from, just like probably most of us sitting up here do, or make all my money from, you know, I'm not sure if the novel is failing, you know, in that regard. I mean, you know, you give us two alternatives, and they're really interesting ones. And on the one hand, there's The Wire, which I actually agree with you. I think is an awesome show, you know, and one of, you know, the sort of the touchstones as we move into a new century. You know, I mean, precisely because of its, you know, the singularity of you know, what it depicts on the show, and its honesty, the fact that it's you know, not character-driven in the sense of false characters, but actually individual-driven, which I'm not sure, based on certain arguments, whether you like or not. But then on the other hand, there's Bret Easton Ellis, who, you know, I mean, if ever there was a sort of an example of like, you know, the court jester legitimizing the very thing that he parodies, it must be Bret Ellis, you know, whose novels I don't read, but I like their existence because I guess people talk about them, but I find them, you know, unreadable in and of themselves. But, you know, I mean, I think it was, I'm totally drawing, who wrote Gender Trouble? Judith Butler. You know, Judith Butler pointed out that you know, parody is the ultimate impotent, you know, or not parody, but satire is the ultimate, you know, impotent complaint against capitalism. You know, when you make fun of something, it legitimizes its place at the top of the food chain without threatening it whatsoever. And, you know, Bret Easton Ellis has made a lot more money making fun of rich people than I've made, you know, writing about poor people. So I'm not sure how he falls in, you know, to that argument, you know, of somehow, you know, criticizing, you know, capitalism in any strong argument. But I feel like I've just confused everything even more. But I've been confused about the piece on some level. I find myself wanting to ask you the question that people were always asking me back in my book review days, which is, what do you like? And I mean, I guess you tell us you like these two books, this book and then this TV show. And I see why you like the TV show. I guess I don't see why you like the book. But I don't see why you don't like all the other things that you don't like. I don't like Roth either. And, you know, I mean, you know, obviously Morrison, like a lot of writers, has kind of gone, you know, she writes about her subject, and her subject is slavery. I don't know the demographics of who, you know, buys her books at this point. You know, we were talking back, you know, earlier about, you know, exactly, you know, how many black people actually buy books, you know, especially of the black books that are sold. But it does seem to continue to be a resonant narrative, and I don't feel that, you know, although I agree with you that an aspect of it is probably to sort of assuage this narrative of American progression towards things better, which I, again, completely agree with you, is an absolutely false narrative. I feel like that can't possibly be the only reason, you know, that the only thing that book is doing out there, that surely it must speak to something beyond that.
All right, we'll come back to all of those questions.
I don't know why y'all are looking at me now, because I'm like... confused.
Well, that's from confusion, you know, dialectical synthesis flows.
Is that right? All right.
No. But
he says he's from Baltimore, and as if the boom culture. I'm from Riverside, California. I spent the night before last trapping a raccoon that was trying to kill my chickens. 8 houses on my block are empty. I got homeless people living in the yard next door. I got marijuana dealers across the street and methamphetamine dealers on the other side. There's no boom. Never was a boom. It's Riverside. We used to have steel mills. We used to have Air Force bases. I live 3 blocks from where I was born. David, the thing about the obituaries is I actually write the obituaries when somebody in my family dies because I'm the writer. So I've probably written 12 obituaries in the last 20 years. Everybody's like, oh, call her. She can write them. So not only do I read the obituaries every morning, I have to be the person to write them. So I feel as if, and I'm a novelist. I mean, that's what I do. I got 3 kids. I raise a bunch of kids, and I write books. I write in my van. I write in a Mercury Villager. The boom never came our way. And I'm thinking of all the things that you're talking about. One of the first books I ever read when I was a kid was Sula. And I always get asked the question, because even though I look like this, I come from a neighborhood and write about African-American culture, which is your favorite Toni Morrison? And I never hesitate to say Sula, because it's the truth. Every year, I reread Sula and Leslie Marmon Soko's book, Ceremony. And every year, my ex-husband, now ex-husband, but we met in the 8th grade. So anyway, every year he would say, why are you reading that book again? Because it was always Sula. And I would say, why are you watching that same John Wayne movie again? And then the conversation would cease. Sula is a beautiful little, well, it would for me anyway, because I'd go back to reading my book. And he'd go back to watching the John Wayne movie. Sula is this beautiful little gem of a novel, and it's not about slavery. But the thing about bringing up slavery is that my oldest kid is a sophomore in college, and she's majoring in African-American studies. She's writing about, and you're laughing, But
I'm not laughing, I'm rolling my eyes.
Here, you know why I'm rolling my eyes? Because she's never going to make any money. Because it really is all about money. In our, it's like, she's writing about her ancestor who was a slave because she's trying to figure out what went wrong at a certain point, not with that person, but with the person who married that person, who was not a slave, who was always a free African-American man. So it's complicated and weird, and everything that you said, like you said, is true and not true, but my existence is so far outside the realm of anything that we're discussing that
well,
what I'm saying...
Well, except you're describing, you know, two things that, that Walter deplored, which, you know,
is
a family-driven narrative and an engagement with the, you know, the idea of slavery, which has been...
It's work, too. Mm-hmm. I just taught a class, a graduate class called Working Class Fiction, and I taught Stuart Onan's novel, Last Night at the Lobster, which is an excellent novel. I know we're supposed to be selling, like, our own stuff, but anyway. Last Night at the Lobster, beautiful novel about the last night at a Red Lobster. I taught Ernest Gaines. Right. Ernest J. Gaines is one of the most overlooked novelists. He does not write about slavery, but writes about this little place in Louisiana over and over again. I taught his book, which is about guys being bonded out from prison and working on a sugarcane plantation because it's free labor. I live in California. You know who fights the fires? My nephews who are in prison. You know, guess how much they get paid? They get paid $1 a day. And that's just the way life is. And the weird part about all of it is, if nobody tells the story and we give up on telling the story, that's not really the question. It's who's going to read the story and who buys the story, who publishes the story. I think that's what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
The fact that some of it's on TV and some of it's in a novel and some of it's in a poem. I was talking to my best friend today, and she decided, and we decided, that American Idol is a group of memoirs. Each person has their memoir, and then they get up on stage and they do their thing, but you know all the stories. Dale's a big American Idol fan. That's what he said.
That's so, surprising.
He says he watches it. He says he's pissed because right now he's missing it.
And that it's on TV.
I'm just saying.
It's waiting for me.
Just saying. I think that the individual and the thing that I loved about Walter's essay was the idea of what Margaret Thatcher said. It's being so reductive. You know, it's like, here it is. There's no society. There's just the individual. But on my block, empty houses, people eating out of the food bank, people selling a lot of drugs. I don't know. I mean, that's the way it is. There's a fatalism on my block about it.
And, you know, again, to sort of steer back to, and I want to give Walter a chance to respond here.
Because I forgot to tell where I'm from and where I live.
I'm sorry.
Well, that is an interesting...
You know, listen, it sounds like we went to personal narrative, but the truth is...
Sounds like, wow.
Straight to...
The truth is, only... forgive me for the geography of it, but, you know, I'm not having any existential crisis about where writing is going or where it's been. I'm, you know, the right, and not
that's
just
what we get paid for, though.
And the writers that I'm reading, you know, they may not be literary fiction in somebody's classical definition, but, you know, everything about Clockers, when I read it, screamed Grapes of Wrath to me, and just as important. And, you know, I feel the same way about that book as the moment I cracked it. I mean, I thought he captured a world, and captured it with such honesty and such clear-eyed conscience. It was just, you know, and Pelicanus's work. I read Drama City, and I think, you know, now I'm not sure if this is not, you know, if from this, if there isn't a little bit of a straw man argument here, where we've removed genre, or we've removed, you know, the essay even seems to remove The Wire, and very complimentary, but saying, you know, remarkable, it's a television show. When in fact, you know, the vast majority of narrative that's being acquired by people in West Baltimore, East Baltimore, is television and hip-hop and video.
The point of the essay is not that while it's a TV show, I probably watch more TV than you do, although it's not, I'm not proud of it. But there's a, you know, one of the things about this is that actually the point for me is not that it's important to be or to have been poor. And actually, I don't think where anybody lives has the slightest thing to do with this, although I you know, the stories are interesting. And it's not actually whether you write about poor people or write about rich people. I think that's a completely empty distinction. You can misrepresent the world about poor people just as you can misrepresent it about rich people, right? The real thing is we live in a society which actually has become, over the last 30 years, an increasingly unjust society. You happen to be living surrounded by people who are experienced in every day. You got to drive a little ways to see them, and you know, you got to go home. And I'm leaving my address out. But the point of it is that we all get that that's been taking place, okay? But we live in a world where, and I'm not, you know, literary fiction happens to be some of the examples because, like, you know, that's what I get paid to read. I'm a literary critic or a literary historian. But watch TV, go to movies, read lots of genre fiction. It's true, lots of genre fiction is sort of about poor people, but the question is how it understands the world. And the reason the memoir is important is because what I wanted to say in the piece is that actually we should stop thinking of ourselves as individuals importantly formed by our family. That is not a neutral political vision. That is a neoliberal political vision in which we think that the world we live in is essentially personalized. It's a matter of making good personal choices and bad personal choices. It's a matter of having the right relation to one's family. It's a matter of what, like neoliberal guys call human capital. All those things are ways of turning something into it being, as it were, about us, about character. You know, I sort of started thinking about writing this piece.
Aren't works of fiction or any narrative works about character?
Yeah. we did an interview for a series of job interviews to hire a creative writer. I mean, and you are a professor at the University of California.
Right? 22 the poor years.
One. Yeah, okay. So we did hire someone like Susan. And we got 14 out of 15 people come in, and someone would say to them the ritual first question, so what is it that's the most important to you about your writing? And they all said character. You want to say the moment when everybody has this kind of worship of character is the moment when character has become complete bullshit. I mean, there are great characters on The Wire, but one of the things, and it's always dangerous to talk about it because, like David can say, that's not what I meant at all, but, you know, trust the tale, not the teller, or whatever they say, is that, in fact, the characters on The Wire are really interesting, but they're deeply subordinated in a certain way to a whole bunch of structures which produce them and within which they operate. And that's like a great thing about the show. That's why, for example, when everybody, who's everybody's favorite character on The Wire? Omar. You guys are such neoliberals. Everybody likes the guy. I mean, I'm not saying I don't like Omar, too.
It's funny because he's...
But everybody likes the guy on The Wire who sort of looks most like what our sort of notion of character is. If your favorite character is Bubbles, see him after class.
It's Dookie.
All right. We can give them all later. The point about this is not like he could have made the same program about the same people and the same, you know, horrible streets of Baltimore. And I will say that I did live in Baltimore for 13 years, but like I didn't live anywhere near, or at least not close enough to matter, to where that was going on. I drove through it fast, you know, when I had to. You could have made that same thing about those same people and totally fucked it up by making it all about these characters and about their struggles and about the way in which they are either not have the opportunity to make good choices or bad choices or whatever. That is the neoliberal novel. The great thing about The Wire was, for whatever reason, like you get full credit for this one, you see right away that no, there's a world out there which is forming these people. And that the choices they make are within that world, the things that encourage that world, and that world has lots of people who are sort of good and sort of bad and doing various ways, but what I call the institutions in the piece are primary. And that's not true, and that's why it's not a TV versus the novel thing, because look at The Sopranos. The Sopranos, to me, was, after the first year of sort of fun, completely empty, because it really was about family and how the family forms the individual and the relation between the individual and the family. So you have these two HBO shows that are the two best HBO shows, the most well-received. One of them is completely the kind of stuff I'm talking about, which seems to me to have as its main job, I don't mean this is what David Chase is trying to do, but its main function in our society is to prop up our sense of the way things are, in personalized, individualized, all of the memoir. And another one, it's the same network, it's the same deal, but it actually works in the exact opposite direction.
Well, The Wire was political dissent, and it was an argument against unencumbered capitalism, and it had a journalistic basis. So without trying to fall into the didactic, I was trying to have an argument about politics.
That's why I like
it. Right, having said that, what I'm a little bit sort of at a loss for is as you indicated, I liked reading Beloved, and I'm being very there. You know, and I'm glad somebody wrote Night, and I'm glad somebody wrote Schindler's List, and I'm glad the personal narrative has a place because
Schindler's List.
What?
I said Schindler's List.
Schindler's List. Yeah.
It's just like, you know, we're killing my illusions.
Dude. Listen, you would be amazed at the stuff that, listen, I like Dreiser.
Well, I like Dreiser too. He's in there.
Can't write a lick. Yeah. Can't write a lick.
Right, yeah. The famous guy can't Dale Dreiser.
Doesn't like what?
Dale doesn't like it.
One thing that, if you asked me that question, if I came to get a job interview with you and you asked me, I wouldn't have said character. I would have said place. Because the one thing that's missing from our discussion is that you brought up Baltimore because that's your place.
Right.
And you brought up your place. And you didn't bring up your place, but I brought my place. I wrote, after the New York Times, the list. See, nobody would ask me. And they might ask you. Nobody would ask me. And nobody would ask most people on the West Coast, but especially no one would ask someone like me because I'm a regional writer in that, if we're going to apply those terms. And I wrote a piece called In Defense of Regionalism. What I loved so much about Homicide, Life on the Streets, was that it was a place. And people in your place talk a certain way. They don't use the same language that anybody in Riverside uses.
Right.
And in Riverside, nobody uses the same language they use in Texas.
And you love that.
Eudora Welty, Flannery O'Connor. I loved Knock'em Stiff, this new Donald Ray Pollock we were talking about. What I loved about Sula was that it was this place, Lorain, Ohio. That's why I read it every time. What I love about Ceremony, the Leslie Marmon Soko, was the place. Last Night at the Lobster, again, he's not paying me. I'm just saying it's a great book. It's a mall in a place called New Britain, Connecticut, during a snowstorm. And, right. I mean, you see this place. That's what I think I realized when you were talking. To me, it's about the place, not just the character.
And how is it that the Holocaust and slavery are not also about place? I mean, I guess
sometimes they are, but I think sometimes when Walter's rolling his eyes because he thinks they're not, then it's true that Schindler's List might not be about the same thing that we're talking about.
How many anti-Semites we have in the room today? I'll be very self-hater.
So, yeah. I have relatives who live in five towns.
It's one. Yeah. Okay.
It comes naturally.
Yeah, all right. You're right. One of the things about it is it's not a question of place. The question of what does it mean? You know, it's the whole pandering thing. What does it mean, like, to write books which tell people like us that we are so right to believe what we already believe, and that we got to keep on making sure that everybody else believes we already believe. There are some poor people out there who haven't quite gotten the whole anti-racism thing down. We got to get them up to speed so they start believing what we believe. And that, in effect, it's like an entire cultural commitment to self-congratulation. Now, there's some level at which culture is always that. Right, so we're just writing about how culture's done that over the last 30 years. But of course, there are also like major works of art which don't do that.
I have to ask, since we're asking the audience question, is there anybody who actually picks up a book to be told something they already know and believe in?
No, it turns out they like it when it happens, though.
I'm hoping
they pick up a book.
I think of myself as a profoundly cynical reader, but even I'm not that cynical as to think that, like, you know, it's a sort of a mutually congratulatory, you know, sort of, you know, call and response thing that's going on there.
I actually do believe that, I have to say.
It's like everybody believes that except you, Dale.
Okay, then maybe I'm the only person who believes it. But
if you read to be challenged, you are in the minority. Most people read to be affirmed.
And most people's ideas, even of being challenged, is pretty limited.
I've always felt like people should be able to read books for whatever reason it is that people want to read books.
That.
But just to return to what we were talking about before, about this idea of character, not versus setting, but versus, I don't know, topic or something like that, you're talking as though it's like an either-or. And I think the reason why The Wire works and why Dreiser is so horrible is because it has both. It may well be a show that wears its politics on its sleeve and has an axe to grind, but it doesn't do so with stick figures. It does so with emotionally, you know, complex people, and that's why, you know, people can buy into it because, you know, the drug dealers aren't all bad and the overworked teachers
aren't
all bad.
And that's what I was trying
to
say is, I read Dreiser, and I admire the idea behind the book, although the execution is disastrous.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that I completely disagree with Dreiser.
But I will also read something that is just a pure tale of of delicate human interaction that has no political import, or maybe is flying in the face of some political argument I might otherwise make and be comfortable with the tail. And I guess I am sort of at a loss as to why all these things can't exist in the same universe. I don't feel one's crowding out the other.
Well, but come on, if you actually look at what's happened over the last 30 years, a whole bunch of them have crowded out the others. I mean, come on, the novel of Descent, as you're characterizing, is minimal. The great thing about Dreiser was that the famous critic Ford Max Ford, great writer, said about Dreiser, man has no talent, only genius. And that actually is deeply true about Dreiser. So, like, if you can't get that, you shouldn't be a literary critic. But there's another way of thinking about this, which is that if you want to look at what these structures of being, the stories that people like to tell each other and to talk to each other about and love to hear over and over again, it's not, I mean, I get that everybody's going to sort of nod and say, well, we don't want stick figures. Although, actually, you know, at a certain moment, maybe we need a few more stick figures. Because there's that kind of mythology about character right now. Even just in there, the sort of deep character as opposed to the shallow one, which is what, like E.M. Forster out of 1926. You want to say, no, there's a certain sense in which just coming on yet another novel or another movie or another whatever the hell it is, which has a kind of profoundly observed character, and once you get to know that person's individuality and all that, that actually, see, I'm not saying there isn't a market for it, there obviously is. What I'm saying is that love of that thing has its own politics. And the alternative is not preaching a different politics. The alternative is imagining sort of different forms. That's why Ellis is interesting. That's why he's way more interesting than anybody else in that list, because he basically doesn't have any characters. He has people who are dressed in clothes. And what those clothes tell you is that they think of themselves as nothing but, and they sort of love being nothing but, struck places, placeholders on a structure, which is ruthlessly up and down, better or worse. So you want to say it's an incredible relief to come across a novel like that one in which you're not once again being confronted with either more talent or less talent by somebody else who's trying to give you character.
I would say that the equivalent that my 17-year-old just told me about is a cable show about Ray J. Mm-hmm. Who's going to get together with Ray J, who's Brandy's little brother, and what's important is what kind of clothes you're wearing and how you get your hair done so that you look good so that you get Ray J. So it seems to me that if the Bret Easton Ellis character were transplanted to reality TV, somebody else would pick out his clothes and do his hair and do all that stuff. But at the end, he would still be trying to get what he got on his own.
Yeah, if there's a place where you want to observe the complete absence of character, it's reality television, right? It is. It's also an interesting performative class thing that's going on out there.
Maybe television would be a good thing from that standpoint.
What's that?
Maybe reality television would be a good thing from that standpoint. I mean, it's an interesting idea if you want to think of it as
there's a VH1 show called I Love Money where these are actually washouts from other failed VH1 reality properties, and it's exactly what it says it is. You know, they're sleeping with each other and scheming against each other for $250,000 at the end of the show. And there is that, even though I'm with Dale on Bret Easton Ellis, I find it deliberately two-dimensional, but uninterestingly two-dimensional. But I do think there is something, you know, weirdly interesting that you were talking before. There are markets for these things. And these, you know, all these shows get developed, as David knows, you know, through a very, you know...
Well, and any book gets written. I mean, you know... Going to a bookstore, there's a lot of crap. There's a lot of crap on television.
I've always been of the view that, you know, you can learn something from crap. You know, there's a lot of interesting...
I don't know. Sometimes porn is just porn.
That's true. And sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. But I do think the question of markets and gatekeepers is interesting, because when you talk about something like the memoir, you're talking about a very market-driven phenomenon, you know, that Oprah abetted, that, you know, we were talking in the back room, that James Fry originally peddled A Million Little Pieces as a novel and was told by his editor, no, make it a memoir.
But
unfortunately, he forgot to make it a novel.
But people do love it, right? And part of the point is, like, we're talking about neoliberal taste. What do people like? Margaret Thatcher, the reason she's so smart about this is because she was saying something that everybody's increasingly coming to believe. People do love this fantasy about themselves, that they have well, I'm about to say something which sounds a little extreme even to me, this, that they have, that their most important relations are to their family, that ridiculous fantasy they have about themselves. But, you know, in a certain sense, it is a kind of ridiculous fantasy. Like, why should your most important, I mean, look around, I don't know, it's hard to tell from up here the sort of age of this audience, but if you look at the way people raise their kids now, the sort of the helicopter parent thing, it obviously is a fantasy that's gone completely berserk, in which the investment people have in the structure of the family is, you know, like,
but
bizarre.
How is that a neo or neoliberal phenomenon? I mean, hasn't the family been important for a fairly long time?
Not that one.
No, sir.
The helicopter parents last 10 years.
I think you pick up the Bible and it's all about who's related to whom and why they got in wars over
But you know, it's about how they're related to each other. It's not how, like, about they cared for each other and they tried to help each other make right choices.
No,
and
it was even worse.
There was no caring.
They just went into wars because they were
related
to each other.
But look, if you think about it, we all know there's a history of the bourgeois family. The bourgeois family gets going. What we're seeing is like a new kind of moment in it, the Corrections is a perfect version of that, because it's like a guy's a talented novelist. It's a version of that in which the sort of sense of family
I really don't see that newness at all. It strikes me as weird. I mean, even when you look at the Margaret Thatcher quote, it makes no sense. She says, you know, there is no such thing as society. There are only individual, and then she immediately breaks it in half into men and women and families, and then she adds families, and then she goes and declares war on the, you know, Argentina because they tried to take the Falklands back, you know, which has like 16 British people on it. I mean,
actually,
the whole thing is a lie.
No, politically, what she's saying made perfect sense. Politically, what she was saying is pay no attention to, I'm about to...
No, I think politically it was expedient. Don't pay any attention to...
It was more than expedient.
It was more expedient, right. But look, it's a deeply political statement, right? Because when she was saying that, what was she doing? She was breaking the miners' union. Okay?
She was breaking what?
The miners' union. That is, and remember, miners.
Okay.
Right? Like your people. All right, so she's breaking the miners' union. So what she's doing, basically, is taking this large, powerful social structure... In Britain, okay, where the unions have been fundamental, and she's breaking the most visible of those unions. And when they start saying, you're destroying the structure of society, she is saying, there is no such thing as society. You don't think of yourselves as belonging to this large collective structure. You should think of yourselves as individuals, and men and women, and then about your families. That's a totally political remark. That is actually the origin of the notion of neoliberalism. So when everybody then says, okay, let's write about that. Let's write about this, just us individuals, and the men's and the women's, and our families. Let's write about that. They're just doing what Margaret Thatcher told them.
What you're talking about, the whole, that's you should be lifting yourself up by your bootstraps then, and you should go to therapy to get over the seductive addictions and all other stuff. That's memoir. We can fix everything if we write about it.
Right, absolutely.
But I would rather go with the whole tribe. We were talking in the back room about tribes too. If you go beyond family, but you're not quite up there to what she's talking about society, then you're really talking about the tribe. And that's really what you're in the wire, and like where I live, it's your tribe. Like there's our family.
At what point do you believe that this fractured along class, along racial lines, maybe now more along class than race, at what point do you believe we were actually reading about the other? Because I don't think it's ever happened. You know, the reason that this is, the reason that you're able to angst over this sort of from an, is that the This plays in New York. This plays to this audience. Mm-hmm. In Baltimore, you know, they want to read about Baltimore. They don't give a shit about New York. All the literary novels out of New York, they're not reading you.
Well, I'm going to speak to the New Yorker.
They're also not reading me, I assure you.
I'm at one New Yorker that this isn't playing to at all. Like, everything you just said about Margaret Thatcher, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know that world.
Well, see, I do. I totally agree with your political analysis of the comment.
But just to apply it to... You embody it.
What do you mean, don't know it? You embody it. Everything you say embodies it.
You know, two books that you've mentioned, you know, before that's come, Beloved and Blood Meridian, and both of those books would seem to stand in direct contrast to this idea of individuals, you know, who are making their own moment and live free of history. Both of those books would, you know, I mean, you have this idea that you know, they're endorsing somehow this progressive view that by writing about the sins in the past, it's as though to say that we've overcome all of that. I mean, I think when you look at those books, it seems very clear what they're saying is that we're not far from that we still, you know, live with all of that.
Okay, but look, that is the whole point, right, is that you have a whole genre of the novel. I mean, I don't say that memoir does exactly the same thing Beloved does, or that all the Philip Roth-like stuff does. The whole point of Beloved is to say, look at this. I mean, you know, the first version of this is Huckleberry Finn. Huckleberry Finn, you all remember the adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Even if you're not into literary fiction, you've at least heard about it. Okay, so the Huckleberry Finn thing is written. It's all about slave and freeing the freed slave. And you remember when it's written. It's written like in late 1870s, early 1880s. So the striking thing about it is even then, what? Slavery actually hasn't existed for some 20 years.
It's a novel about... does exist.
No, it doesn't, because it's actually being radically transformed into modern racism, modern Jim Crow.
Slavery,
Jim Crow slavery, is like totally
no,
different.
No, I'm sorry, slavery effectively existed until they invented the mechanical cotton picker. Until they didn't need labor anymore in about 1942... Slavery existed.
Yeah, that's not true, though. Unless you're going to, I mean, and then you're going to
take
just make,
any take any history of the Mississippi
but
Delta.
But then you're just going to make. You're going to make. If you, the whole point of this is there's a kind of. I have a friend who once says,
"Are you going to argue your way out of Huck Finn? Are you really going that far?"
I like Huck Finn, but it's got a few flaws. I'm just saying. And here's and it's the kind of archetype for Beloved, because precisely what it does is sort of take a relatively uncontroversial position, and in Beloved, it's a completely uncontroversial position. When Beloved was written, I flat guarantee you that there's no one who was ever going to pick up Beloved and was going to say, you know, I just think that the slavery thing should have kept on going.
No, but you know,
and when you do that, then people always say something like, well, what we want to do here
is a straw
see this
man.
Is ongoing.
This
but
is a straw
man. Why do they write those Holocaust
books?
This
is a straw man. You know what? Slavery still exists.
Yeah.
And you know where it still exists? It exists.
Wage slavery may exist, but slavery doesn't. It's a big fucking difference.
You know what? It is a continuum.
Can I tell you what happens during Huck Finn?
Let me finish. If you drive down to the Shape Up, down at the 7-Eleven over on Broadway, five blocks from where I live, slavery still exists. Now, it's a continuum, and they get to go back to their own hovels, but they got to work for shit, and they got to suffer through shit, and you know the whole concept of the immigration laws is determined to create a farcical modern-day version of wage slavery. Now, if you're going to say that that's not on the same continuum of economic betrayal as you know official slavery, that's just you're being so deconstructionist. You're saying you know we have nothing to learn by the experience of anybody you know prior to 1865.
No, but the point is not that we have nothing to learn from like historical
so let
whatever
the book
it is.
Let it be. Let it breathe.
the Huck Finn.
Okay.
I got three girls, right? They're seven different racial backgrounds. My ex-husband looks like Shaquille O'Neal, but he's a little shorter. He's 6'4 and weighs 310. He's a correctional officer. We have these three girls. Each one of my girls takes AP classes, advanced placement. They're often the only black kid in their class, okay? And every time Huck Finn comes up, I know I'm going to get this story. Everybody got to use the word nigger, they got to say it all during class, and they got to look at me because they got to use it for free, and then they got to ask me whether my ancestors picked cotton. Now, okay, we didn't come from that part, but imagine being still deconstructed to the point of, I'm a young black woman, I'm in an AP class, and for me, the entire experience of Huck Finn, we don't even get to talk about the book. We get to throw around the N-word, look at my reaction, and then actually bring cotton to class and say, did your ancestors pick this? Then my kids aren't slaves, no, but they still have to hear that crap over and over again. So the discussion to me about what we're talking about literature, I'm looking at it in a completely different way because I'm looking at how kids are going to read the same books we're talking about, Beloved, Huck Finn, they're going to watch The Wire. What do they see?
But look here, look, I totally take that point, but just think of it this way. During the last 30 years, America has not, I mean, America's no doubt still a racist country, right? Obama to the contrary notwithstanding. But during the last 30 years, America has not gotten more racist. During the last 30 years, the U.S. has not, like, tried to figure out ways to do more slavery. What the U.S. has done is, in a certain sense, pursue a strongly anti-discriminatory line with some success, but not total success. Anti-discrimination is what neoliberalism loves, because discrimination and exploitation, and this is why the slavery thing matters, are importantly very different. The thing we started out with, like the very first paragraph, the little thing I read today, just points out that actually the U.S. is a more unequal society now than it was 30 years ago. And it's not because we're reintroducing slavery. It's not because it's more racist. It's not because it's more sexist. It's because all the talk about racism and sexism and discrimination have actually managed to obscure a genuine social justice issue, which is that we are way more economically unequal than we were before. And that goes, as you know well, because you write about this, that goes for white people too. White people are like, what, 70% of the American population. White people are like 60% of the bottom quintile. So they're underrepresented. Black people are overrepresented at the bottom and underrepresented at the top. So we get there's ongoing racism, but the majority of poor people today in the U.S. are white. They're not the victims of racism. They are not the victims of slavery in race-based slavery in that model. They're not the victims of sexism as such. They're the victims of capitalism.
Wait.
And in fact, everybody wants to talk about everything except capitalism.
But that's really what we're talking about because we're talking about publishing, marketing, gatekeepers, and HBO. So you're just talking about money. Everything always comes back to money.
Are you under the impression that if narrative focused on our legitimate social ills and our socio-political injustices... that it would have any effect? Do you really believe that, like, that there's an Uncle Tom's Cabin out there for economic disparity?
No, but what do you think, though? I mean, no, but sorry, this is a real question for you. What do you think? Do you think that, I mean, I definitely do think that all the stories we tell each other have a kind of legitimating effect. They make us feel a lot better. Presumably, no one here supports the inequality. But they all make us feel a lot better about it because we're all anti-racist, we're all anti-sexist, and they play an ideological role. So yeah, they make people feel good about themselves. They make people feel that they're somehow on the left if they're for gay marriage. Okay?
You know, listen, I don't think journalism has the slightest bit of effect.
Yeah, well, I agree with that.
And that's actually dealing with, you know, they're the ones citing these statistics on which they're the ones who have, even in places where journalism has made a fine accounting for what's gone wrong in the country, it's been met with a gaping yawn. And I do not believe that The Wire is going to convince any public official to pursue any different policy other than the one that a moneyed oligarchy chooses.
I think we can stipulate that art isn't created to make policy.
Right.
So if but I do totally think I do think there is something when I was wrestling with a lot of these questions editing Walter's essay, I kept returning to the 20th century version of the boom culture that we just went through was in the 1920s. And there actually, you did have a diversity of a story. You had Dreiser, you had Sinclair Lewis, you had John Dos Passos, who were writing from different class
advantages.
You had
a whole leftist culture.
You're setting up my point perfectly.
All the leftist political culture in the world didn't amount to shit.
Well, it amounted to shit. I think you could say that it created an environment where the New Deal was thinkable.
It created a brief window. It didn't create anything. What created the excesses of the policy led to a complete economic collapse.
Right.
Right. And that and the excesses of in the same way that. In the same way that the excesses of industrial policy in the 1880s led to somebody throwing a bomb in the Haymarket.
David, don't you believe the political cultures make differences? If so, how come Denmark is like way more equal than we are? How come France is more equal? How come Germany is more equal? It's not homogenous. When was the last time you were in France? I assure you, that is
not
true.
By the way, France has the same problems with inequality that we do now. Go to the Paris suburbs.
That's why Paris keeps
Denmark
go to the Paris being on fire.
Denmark, yes. France, no.
Listen, and also Denmark
half the adult
is not
black males
either.
In my city are unemployed. Right. Okay, that's not marginal. That's not. You can't diffuse that with it's 60%, but not quite. But it's better.
Sure you can. How? It's a real statistic. Look. And in terms of like poverty, black people are for sure overrepresented. That is, black people are around 13% of the population. Black people are around 20% of the poor.
Because
that's overrepresentation.
Because our service economy decided a long time ago that black and brown people were not necessary in the numbers that we had them to the running of the economy.
Well, I just think the idea through.
The only thing new is that they've thrown a few white people down
the
tubes.
Suppose you cured all that, right? Suppose you made it so that actually we really got rid of racism and the history of racism. And instead of black people being like 21% of the poor, they were 13.4% of the poor. And instead of white people being 60%, they were 70%. You still wouldn't have any more equal society.
No, of course you would.
Different skin colors at the bottom.
You start kicking the shit out of white people, and things start to change.
Right.
So far, not so much.
No, let me tell you something.
$2 trillion stimulus package that we all have to pay for?
When the sentencing guidelines were throwing black and brown people nonviolent offenders into prison.
Crack versus powder.
Yeah, crack versus cocaine. Right. White people didn't blanch. Yeah. This was all law and order. This was all good. Let some white people start getting caught up in it. And all of a sudden, they got to change the Rockefeller laws. You know, at a certain point, you know, the reason, the reason that Vietnam became an opposable war was they were drafting white kids. You know, you start fucking with white people. You know, start fucking with Philip Morris and with the liquor distributors the way you fuck with narcotics, and all of a sudden you'll see a real serious attention being given to the idea of drug decriminalization. But as long as we're just screwing with black and brown people, that can go on forever.
Yeah, but you know, I think goes to your question, like art can play a role in changing, you know, affluent white people's perception of what's going on. But I think your show has played that role.
White people going to jail. That's
I keep thinking of time when I'm teaching a class and we're talking about kids, you know, graduate students wanting to publish. I don't care what color they are. I don't care what they're writing about. Anything like that. You're just talking about the marketplace. That there were, you know, a former professor of mine's in the audience, and he gave me Flannery O'Connor when I was in graduate school. All right, I had never read Flannery O'Connor because they tried to give it to us in high school, but the title of the story was The Artificial Nigger, and then there was a riot, and then we didn't read it. So I had never read it, and he gave me Flannery O'Connor. I'm sorry, but that's what happened, and then we all got to go home for a week.
So literature does make a difference.
It did for us. It seems to me as if when I read Flannery O'Connor, I looked through. I was a graduate student, and I wanted to publish, and I wanted to publish stories about Riverside. Yeah, it was dumb. I'm still doing it 25 years later. It was like, why don't you write about New York? I didn't know anything about New York. I looked at where those stories were published, and I always tell this story to my graduate students. Mademoiselle, all these great, you know, Saturday Evening Post. There was a place for fiction, and people read fiction, and they used their imaginations, and they learned about each other. They learned about characters they would have never read. That's what really I think the death is. It's not the death of this, that, or the other, or some of the stuff we're arguing about, it's the death of the imagination. Because if you look at memoir, there's not as much imagination required if you're going to call it a memoir, whether it's real or James Fry. Don't even get me started on like whether it's real or not. With my students, I'm like, if you're going to lie, it's called fiction. If you're going to tell the truth, you better get your mama's dialogue right or she's going to kick your butt, okay? And I'll back her up on that. But if you look at memoir, it doesn't require the same investment of imagination. Now, my kids, they watch YouTube. Bon Cui Cui would be a big favorite of theirs, which is from Mad TV, in case you want to check that one out. They're watching YouTube. They're watching this and that and the other. They're still reading fiction probably because they feel sorry for me. They, you know, I mean, they're like, let's pick up a novel so mom thinks she's going to make some money and send us to college one day. That could be their thinking. But the death of the imagination, there's a way that brains work differently now, but it's not out there like it was before. Fiction's not out there. And I'm not, we talked about narrative in the back room. The Wire is a different narrative. But narrative itself, as fiction, requires you to imagine being in the place like Knock'em Stiff or in Last Night at the Lobster. Going away.
I think that reading memoirs does that too. For me, the real problem with memoirs is not so much the lack of imagination that goes into them, although I do think we suffer from a general cultural lack of imagination, but the fact that so many of them, regardless of whether they're actually true or not, are all imagined, because most memoirs, the form that memoir has taken is not actually about being an individual, but it's about being a public persona that you present as an individual, which usually looks one of like three or four types, you know, whether you're hero or victim of overcomer or something like that. And I think that, you know, it sort of meets on the other side, you know, with this sort of paucity, you know, where maybe I come closest to Walter, which is an inability to imagine the world that we actually live in, you know, all that much. And so, you know, things get displaced.
But people think it's real. So they don't use their authenticity.
I think that people like to think that it's real, because I think that for me, most people who read memoirs read them because they want to think that a meaningful life is still somehow possible in this age where meaningful lives are rarely possible for most people, mostly because of late market capitalism and the fact that it's sort of, you know, stripped any meaning out of the work that we do. So, you know, you read that because you want to think that, well, if I can go inside and if I can find some kind of existential triumph, you know, like this memoir writer has, you know, that I can, you know, then maybe I'll be, you know, successful too or something. But mostly when I read memoirs, I see people who have learned how to write about their experiences, but not actually made them make any more sense, you know, to themselves.
And yet if we're so fractured that the world we live in, it can't be defined to anyone's satisfaction. I mean, there are people who look at The Wire, they come to it, and they say, this is, you know, if I'm not going to watch this as some sort of travel type thing of going to a place I never will go, this is not my America. And they're not wrong on some level. Whereas, you know, people in West Baltimore might be watching Friends and thinking, you know, what the fuck? have we ever really seriously, like, you know, I really want to see the world. A lot of us do want to see the world we live in. But, you know, to quote Tip O'Neill, all politics is local, maybe all literature too. And ultimately, that may be the problem, is that, you know, human empathy only goes so far. You know?
Well, actually, Walter, I had something.
I was just going to ask if the audience got to say something. I could say more, but
there's an audience. You were just ranting up here.
I'm just people's faces of intense skepticism. And I think that when they have this intense skepticism, they should be allowed to present.
Can I have a mic for past you, so you actually want to hear you?
I think one of the big shifts that isn't being acknowledged is that in the last 30 years, literature really isn't the popular entertainment. I mean, I adored The Wire, but if you look at what was actually subversive, I would say The Cosby Show and Roseanne were more powerful than The Wire, mm-hmm. though I watched every minute of The Wire and less so The Cosby Show. But I think TV really emerged as a more popular entertainment. I mean, in movies, Will Smith is the biggest box office star in the world. That laid the groundwork for Obama and for the world to change. Right. That's subversive. I don't think novels are really catering to the same broad audience.
Yeah, you know, I think that's really true. But the only thing I would say, that's going back to the original piece, and others have different things, is that it's not for me so much about, it's sort of more like about what makes great art than it is about whether how art has a political effect. The question of art's political effect is a complicated one sometimes, and it depends on a lot of different things. But what I'm really interested in is the way in which most of the art that I'm describing, and actually haven't heard a lot of what count to me, at least, as convincing exceptions in the discussion here, most of it actually plays the role of sort of embodying a lot of the presuppositions of the period that we've been living in for the last 30 years. And the piece was just meant to sort of define what some of those are, sketch them out, you could do more. And what's interesting about, like, great art is that great art has a much more complicated relation to those things. And it's not just because it's subversive, although maybe it can be sometimes. Sometimes it can be radically non-subversive, like radically conservative in a certain way. But it's that it sort of has a better take, whether it's intuitive or intellectual or whatever it is, on the way the world is actually being structured. And it's that, again, that's what I liked right away. I'm sure a lot of people had the same experience when you first watched The Wire. I happened to watch it when it first went on, the very first thing. And you're watching this thing, and you're watching about 20 minutes in, and you're thinking, I don't understand anything anyone said, you know? I mean, somebody must have said that to you at some point, which is, why are you going to start with, like, no one understand a single word? There you go. Well, I'm not
My
quite
parents,
old enough, but almost.
They still keep saying
it. So you say, I understand it, but you say, you know, it reminded me, like, there's a famous remark made, it's going to seem different, but I'm telling you it's the same, made by T.S. Eliot. He claimed that, the poet, back in the day, right, he claimed that when he first read Dante, he didn't speak Italian. He starts reading the Inferno, and he says, even though he didn't speak Italian, he could tell 7 or 8 lines in, this was serious stuff. That's the way The Wire works, okay? And that's why, because, all right, that's a little bit of hyperbole there, but I'm just saying, you know, compared to like Toni Morrison, that's the way, and part of the point is, it's because it has a vision of the world which isn't simply repeating the vision of the world that we all have. So I absolutely believe that. But you know, I think I don't think Watergate and Vietnam exploded. I mean, Vietnam exploded. You know, David said before about what the difference was in kids getting drafted. But there's a different way to put that. You know, that's my age. We were all eligible for the draft. We all had very strong views on this war. And it was not just because there were white kids who could go to this war. It was because there were middle and upper middle class kids who could go to this war. And there's a way in which one of the great catastrophes for the left in the U.S. was that the left in the U.S. turned out to be able at a crucial moment to define itself by being above all against the Vietnam War. And it's not like a complete accident that it's within 7 or 8 years of the end of that war that we have a kind of consensus on what leftism is in this country, which has very little to do with redistribution of wealth. You know, what I'm interested in is redistribution of wealth. And like being against Vietnam wasn't going to help you with the redistribution of wealth. Being against Iraq isn't going to help you with that. Being all the things that we've been talking about before. So to me, you know, it's not so much a question of what has the greatest social effect. And I think he's probably right. Probably the wire has almost no social effect. But actually it's what makes it a significant work of art. And that's, to me, what's attractive about it.
Oh. Hi. Talking about significant works of art, on the way over here, I was on the subway and there was a woman next to me reading the corrections, and I thought, having just read your piece, you know, how like incredibly in the last pisteam this person must be, you know, reading this book. And I like
the corrections.
Yeah, and I when I was thinking about it just now, and I thought, you know, it's really not, you know, about family insofar as the family members actually never, you know, they kind of come together, but it's, you know, these separate stories about these different characters, and the main, you know, point of view character is kind of like this, you know, anti-neoliberal Marxian, nostalgic Marxian type. And I thought, you know, when you say no more books like The Corrections, I would almost think that you just mean an end to kind of realistic narrative, or do you mean a kind of, like, a narrative that lacks a bourgeois perspective, like, say, Clockers, which was mentioned, or do you mean basically are you implying that The Corrections marks an end of something that maybe started with Dreiser's, say, Trilogy of Desire, and that kind of, you know, that sort of, you know, angle toward realism, and that's, you know, that was what was unclear. And then when we bring in these other things like The Sopranos, I just see sort of an extension of, you know, that kind of realism.
Yeah,
forever.
That's like a totally serious question, obviously. So you should take that one. I know that you're eager to talk about this.
I'm dying to jump
in. Like, yeah, I mean, first of all, Chris actually called me on that. Said, why the corrections? Because for part of the reasons you gave, the sort of the neo-Marxian sort of narrator stuff, that
and
seems like a bad
title
way.
The title of the book refers to market corrections.
Right, absolutely. So there's a way in which it was a kind of cheap shot. But the reason I wanted to take it in anyway was because
he likes cheap shots.
Yeah. You know, I mean, come on, a literary critic. What do you get to do? You know. So because for part of what you're saying, which is that the structure of the thing is still very much revolves around a certain depth of character, a certain way of thinking about the formation of character, and a certain way of thinking about, you know, bourgeois realism really seems like so 1938, and so whereas neoliberal realism seems to be a little more attractive, although it's obviously delusional. I think there's a big difference between those two. But it is partly that. It's partly that there's a certain sense, and maybe, you know, it's just me and like 9 other people, but you get, when you open a book like that, which you know there are going to be certain kinds of pleasures of a certain novel, kind of novel, but you know also there's these characters, there's this story, it's going to go on, they're going to have these relationships. You want to say, why are we reading this over and over and over again at this moment? I mean, there's a certain sense in which I think Chris asked me to do this. He said, the end of boom culture. And I said to him, look, I actually don't even have the concept of exactly boom culture. But what if we could imagine it was the end of capitalism? And then, like, write a thing about what that would be. And you want to say, yeah, that maybe at the end of capitalism, and this is not so surprising, you know, at the end of capitalism, there wouldn't be any more novels. And that's not obviously a bad thing.
That's great. Thanks for sending my kids to college. Like, so what are you paying for that?
Right, you know, capitalism isn't going to come for it. At the end of capitalism, you're okay because Obama
I feel
is
so
not going
to
kill
now.
Capitalism.
Obama's there are tea parties across the country that beg to do.
In sort of sense, but in a way, it's kind of not so much so from like, you know, the Capulet character in Dreiser. You know, strangely. It's almost, it seems to be the same, you know, those characters.
Yeah, well, we should maybe talk more after this, because probably everybody isn't that into Dreiser in this, but I would say it is like...
Certainly no one else
different.
Had the parents.
Yeah, it's like...
Not even Dreiser.
Yeah.
This is just a comment from the discussion at the beginning. I think there was a certain disconnect up on the stage when you talked about the boom, and then you said, oh, the boom never reached my community. That was the boom. The boom has been 30 years of stagnating wages. The boom has been credit deployed as the only strategy for working class people to maintain their income. The boom has been the financial Katrinas that have decimated poor and working class communities. That is the boom. That's what he's talking about. So, yeah, the boom
there
did
was
reach
no disconnect.
Community.
I got the equivocation of what he was saying.
I was saying
that where from the land of storytelling that I inhabit, I'm not overcome with any sense of dissonance between what I, you know, I mean, I'm reading a lot of writers who are writing about that world. In my, you know, they all happen to be considered genre, which is, you know, I can
George
get into that.
George Balakanos, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I read a lot of people who are writing dead on about this stuff and have been for years. So I'm not feeling the same sense of, you know, oh my God, you know, I wasted my time reading these brooding, introspective, onanistic, you know, I wasn't. You know? And so that, my comment about Baltimore wasn't flippant. And I understand exactly, agree exactly with his socioeconomic take on what the boom was or wasn't, because I live in Baltimore. But but I guess what I'm saying is, you know, I the equivocation was there in how he put it, and it's accurate, and I perceived it that way.
I just wanted to follow up on what one or two other people had brought up. I don't find it very relevant to bring up the novel in terms of a real discussion of the economy in the last 30 years and pop culture, because the novel has always been read primarily by women, and it really emerged as something that came out of the bourgeoisie. And so to me, it makes sense that the novel would reaffirm these values and be more about feelings. There's always been subgenres within it, but really women read novels and women read to feel, A. B, I think that in terms of what's been happening with the economy, you're dead on, but it's more interesting to me, I don't really see the facility in asking artists why they say what they say, because artists create out of feeling or desire. It's more interesting to say, what does the audience actually pay attention to? And in the last 30 years, to me, what's relevant is the emergence of hip-hop culture. And I think that's been a direct response to this divergence of the economy, because we've seen a whole level of subculture basically trying to also play like Donald Trump, you know, and running around in all these videos. And what was interesting to me about The Wire is instead of the glamorized ghetto culture, which tried to look on a level with Donald Trump, he was presenting a real world. So I just want to hear David Simon do a little analysis of the hip-hop culture that's been glamorized so much versus your representation.
Well, we had no interest in the more gangster than now stuff in hip-hop. I mean, I'm an admirer of the musical form. I'm less of an admirer of the stance, if that makes sense. You know, I kind of wish hip-hop had gone in the direction of Public Enemy and De La Soul. In a way, I'm old school. And disappointingly so to a lot of the
a lot of
the guys who wanted to be on the show.
Do you like Jay-Z?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm not so much a
another
Jay-Z
great guy. Artist. I'm
just but... But I do love the democratization of that. I do love what hip-hop has said, you know, in terms of, you know, the microphone and the turntable and the stance. I like, if I don't like necessarily the gangster than now, the more gangster than now stance, I do love the individual bravado of it, of the voiceless suddenly having a comprehensive voice and singular voice. Anything, you know, I used to love to hang out on corners in Baltimore, and this goes back to the early 80s when all that, you know, Grandmaster Flash hadn't landed yet, and just hear guys insulting each other's mothers. There was a poetry to how people talked that was, the oral tradition was epic, and the wit involved was something, you know, and they were so quick and so genuinely funny. And it was, I can't quite describe it, but it was, there was something that could not be taken away from the worst neighborhood in Baltimore, wherever you went. There were people there who were being so distinctly valuable as individuals in the moment that it was one of the great wonders I had as a police reporter. I used to love it. So, I mean, I God bless it to a point. And then at the point where, you know, it's all about, you know, jewelry and cars and women and, you know, and guns, I get a little tired and a little sad for what might have been.
My question's mostly for Walter, I guess. I just wonder whether, you know, some of the books, and I guess Beloved is a particular example, whether it's possible that, you know, that sort of in spite of these books, in spite of themselves, that the books might have sort of like an allegorical function or like allow some of their readers to end up reflecting on the very sort of contemporary political realities that you would want the books to be dealing with in the first place. That, you know, perhaps it's an extra step. But, I wonder what, I mean, sort of, I know we didn't talk about sort of multiculturalism all that much here. I know you obviously talk about it elsewhere. But is it possible that something that sort of you might peg as sort of problematically niche might allow its readers to actually take a step back, even if it's set in the past, and look at their contemporary moment?
That's a good question. A really quick answer is that I do think it certainly does serve. This piece for here, I just sort of focused on the fact that it was about slavery. But there's actually also a crucial thing about it, which is it's very much about identity. You guys had that discussion last week. I was curious to know how it came out. Mm-hmm. Like an audience vote at the end. But there's a way in which it seems to me that would be the American Idol version of this. It seems to me there's a way in which part of what it does is precisely give you a kind of model of what black identity was going to look like in the 80s and 90s from a sort of bourgeois standpoint, but there's class politics in the black community as well. And one of the questions you want to ask is, so what is the political meaning of multiculturalism? Well, there's books out there, I think. The reason that book is called The Trouble with Diversity is because I argue that the political meaning of multiculturalism is profoundly conservative. That is, what it's committed to is sort of promoting values of identitarian respect and tolerance, which are completely good in themselves, but which manage to create for us and recreate for us in the 21st century Du Bois's famous remark that the 20th century, the problem of the 20th century was the problem of the car line. We repeat that for ourselves. We take Toni Morrison to be attacking racism in the present, which you know that is. We all completely agree that racism in the present is a bad thing. But while we're all sort of lining up to congratulate ourselves and trying to be more and more anti-racist, we are absolutely calmly going forward and participating in the economy, which is making the people, like the people in this room, richer and richer as they become more and more anti-racist. So at some point you want to say, what is the value of anti-racism for a left politics? It doesn't mean anti-racism isn't a good thing. No one's defending racism. It means that at this moment in American history, anti-racism is completely empty as a left politics, as is anti-homophobia, as is anti-sexism. All those things are about sort of, just distributing the races and the sexes and the genders and the sexualities appropriately at the different scales of American wealth. Well, so for me, you can't understand that stuff unless you read it against the backdrop of what's been happening economically, which is the inequality that we're all sort of agreed on.
But to recycle a line from last week's Passover Seder, freedoms can't be can never be wholly won, but they can be lost. These things are so insidious and so comprehensive and so worldwide, racism, sexism, homophobia, that they bear repeating. And it's hard for me to imagine that there isn't room for them in the pantheon of literature or television or storytelling, I should say, along with the other things that obviously I enjoy doing and you seem to like as well. But I'm not sure that, it just feels like, let all the stories out there and let them run around crazy. And
I know you love to say that.
I don't feel like I got beat up because somebody was reading Beloved and wasn't busy watching The Wire.
No, you're one of the beneficiaries of neoliberalism, as am I. But look, think of it this way. Look, what have we all seen in the last week? We've seen this unbelievable, like Iowa, emerging to pass a bill which effectively
It was a court decision that struck court decision. Down a previously big
yeah, right. So you know more about than I do. But the point about it is I can go get married in Iowa. And elsewhere this is happening. And what does everybody say in the paper every single day? It's like so amazing this could happen in just 15 or 20 years. And it is amazing. Come on. If you're as old as I am, if someone had said to me when I was like 18 years old, whoa, and there's going to be gay marriage, you would have had to explain the whole thing and then work it through. It seemed unimaginable. Why can we make extraordinary progress? By no means enough. Gay marriage should be legal in every goddamn state in the Union and every country in the world, as far as I'm concerned. But it's a striking thing that's precisely the kind of issue that we as a society have made a lot of progress on, because that's completely compatible with neoliberalism. And that while we're making all that progress there and congratulating ourselves, in this case, absolutely rightly on that, we are at the same time living in a society which has become progressively more unjust and a fundamental.
Aren't you kind of restating, I think it was Dale at the outset of the conversation said, you know, we live in a historical moment where there is no alternative to capitalism. And, you know, to talk about capitalism is somehow, you know...
Right. But that was the point of your piece, right? Is that actually if this crisis does one thing, the thing it's supposed to do is give us the possibility of being able to talk about an alternative to capitalism.
But it's also the case that without some, you know, what socialists used to call a historically existing alternative to capitalism, you do have, you know, a situation where, for instance, you can't, at a certain level, you can't imagine the Grapes of Wrath, say, without Clifford Odets. You know, there is a continuum there of, you know, a kind of didactic socialist art creating a broader, more ecumenical vision of, you know, an experience of poverty that, yes, you know, art was able to make people identify universally with. It was about white people, yes, but it was also, you know, and I was thinking about this in reference to the Wire, actually, because, you know, the Wire very effectively captures this kind of sense of total isolation from mainstream culture. It is a world unto itself, where outside influences don't penetrate in terms of the dominant, you know, culture of achievement and success and all that.
Except Stringer Bell.
But the Grapes of Wrath, you know, was this recognizable, you know, people were able to...
That's a big social novel.
Right.
And what I've been hearing in the last... Since, I mean, the whole death of boom culture, like you said, in Riverside, we have 13% unemployment. we do boom... death of boom culture so well because we never got the boom and we haven't been booming since the 80s. The thing about that is there's no great social novel right now that people want to read because they would rather have light and fluffy because they're scared. Everybody knows the newspapers are dying. You said that you could publish a great piece about all this and it would be met with a colossal yawn. Newspapers are going away. Who wants to read The Grapes of Wrath right now? Instead, people are like, I don't want to hear that. I want Sex in the City. I want to watch American Idol because I don't want to be depressed. I don't want to think. And I mean, where I live, it's cash economy all the way. Mm-hmm. Some things never change. People are always going to want certain things and they're going to pay cash for them. And like you said about, it's completely divorced from a lot of what we're talking about. People are going to do what they're going to do, but are they still going to read? I don't know.
And you're absolutely right, which is that ultimately, people will, you know, in a way, acquiring story is often an escapist moment. Maybe a healthily escapist moment. But, you know, I mean, a novel that I love, you know, Humphrey Cobb, Paths of Glory, and the movie, of course, which I adore, I think is one of the most important political movies. I stole liberally from it in The Wire. Mm. And it died in the theater. As great a movie as it is, the cinematography, the story—it died, and nobody wanted to watch it. And this was in the middle of—he was speaking to sort of the fundamental problems of man versus institutions, for the whole century. It wasn't a World War I novel; it wasn't even a war movie. But people looked at it and said, this is unpleasant. They're really going to shoot those guys? And the vast majority of culture has always gone that way. I mean, you know, if you write a sad story, some people will come, but a lot are going to be kind of resentful that they're being made to sit through a sad story.
And people assign The Grapes of Wrath and Huck Finn and Beloved in college classrooms. They assign The Grapes of, you know, Grapes of Wrath is one of those big, great read books that entire cities do. But what will be The Grapes of Wrath for right now? How do you write that now? How do you get it published now? Who's going to read it now?
I think on this very joyous note, perfectly befitting of a cultural obituary, the talent on stage will sign books, but before that, a round of applause. Thank you very much. Thank you.